largely a duel of firepower, Sukomlinov treated with contempt. Greater only than his aversion to fire tactics was Sukomlinov's aversion to the Grand Duke Nicholas, who was 8 years his junior and represented the reforming tendency within the army. 6 foot 6, of narrow height, with handsome head, pointed beard, and boots as tall as a horse's belly, the Grand Duke was a gallant and imposing figure. After the Japanese War, he had been named to reorganize the army as chief of a Council of National Defense. Its purpose was the same as that of the Escher Committee after the Boer War, but unlike its British model, it had soon succumbed to lethargy and the Mandarins. The reactionaries, who resented the Grand Duke for his share in the Constitutional Manifesto and feared his popularity, succeeded in having the council abolished in 1908. As a career officer, who had served as Inspector General of Cavalry in the Japanese War, and who knew personally almost the entire officer corps, each of whom, on taking up a new post, had to report to him as commander of the St. Petersburg district, the Grand Duke was the most admired figure in the army. This was less for any specific achievement than for his commanding size and looks and manner, which inspired confidence and awe in the soldiers, and either devotion or jealousy in his colleagues. Brusque, and even harsh in manner to officers and men alike, he was regarded outside court as the only man in the royal family. Peasant soldiers who had never seen him told stories in which he figured as a sort of legendary champion of Holy Russia against the German clique and palace corruption. Echoes of such sentiments did not add to his popularity at court, especially with the Tsarina, who already hated Nikolasha because he despised Rasputin. "I have absolutely no faith in N," she wrote to her husband. "I know him to be far from clever, and having gone against a man of God, his work cannot be blessed or his advice good." She constantly suggested that he was plotting to force the Tsar to abdicate and, relying on his popularity with the army, to place himself on the throne. Royal suspicions had kept him from the chief command during the war with Japan, and consequently from the blame that followed. In any subsequent war, it would be impossible to do without him, and in the pre-war plans he had been designated to command the front against Germany, the Tsar himself expecting to act as commander-in-chief with a chief of general staff to direct operations. In France, where the Grand Duke went several times to manoeuvres, and where he came under the influence of Foch, whose optimism he shared, he was extravagantly fêted as much for his magnificent presence, which seemed a reassuring symbol of Russian might, as for his known dislike of Germany. With delight, the French repeated the remarks of Prince Kotzebue, the Grand Duke's aide, who said his master believed that only if Germany were crushed once for all and divided up again into little states, each happy with its own little court, could the world expect to live in peace. No less ardent a friend of France was the Grand Duke's wife Anastasia and her sister Militsa, who was married to the Grand Duke's brother Peter. As daughters of King Nikita of Montenegro, their fondness for France was in direct proportion to their natural hatred of Austria. At a royal picnic in the last days of July 1914, the Montenegrin Nightingales, as Palaiolog called the two princesses, grouped themselves beside him, twittering about the crisis. "There's going to be a war. There will be nothing left of Austria. You will get back Alsace-Lorraine. Our armies will meet in Berlin." One sister showed the ambassador a jewelled box in which she carried soil from Lorraine, while the other told how she had planted seeds of Lorraine thistles in her garden. For the event, the Russian general staff had worked out two alternate plans of campaign, the ultimate choice depending upon what Germany would do. If Germany launched her main strength against France, Russia would launch her main strength against Austria. In this case, four armies would take the field against Austria and two against Germany. The plan for the German front provided for a two-pronged invasion of East Prussia by Russia's First and Second Armies, the first to advance north and the second south of the barrier formed by the Masurian Lakes. As the First or Vilna Army, named for its area of concentration, had a direct railway line available, it would be ready to start first. It was to advance 2 days ahead of the Second or Warsaw Army and move against the Germans with the object of drawing upon itself the greatest possible enemy strength. Meanwhile, the Second Army was to come around the lake barrier from the south, and moving in behind the Germans, cut off their retreat to the Vistula River. The success of the pincer movement depended upon concerted timing to prevent the Germans from engaging either Russian wing separately. The enemy was to be attacked energetically and determinedly whenever and wherever met. Once the German army was rounded up and destroyed, the march on Berlin, 150 miles beyond the Vistula, would follow. The German plan did not contemplate giving up East Prussia. It was a land of rich farms and wide meadows, where Holstein cattle grazed, pigs and chickens scuttled about inside stone-walled farmyards, where the famous Trakehnen stud bred remounts for the German army, and where the large estates were owned by Junkers, who, to the horror of an English governess employed by one of them, shot foxes instead of hunting them properly on horseback. Further east, near Russia, was the country of still waters, dark woods, with wide-flung lakes fringed by rushes, forests of pine and birch, and many marshes and streams. Its most famous landmark was Romanten Forest, the Hohenzollern hunting preserve of 90,000 acres on the edge of Russia, where the Kaiser came each year, attired in knickerbockers and feathered hat, to shoot boar and deer, and an occasional Russian moose, who, wandering innocently over the border, offered itself as target to the imperial gun. Although the native stock was not Teutonic but Slavic, the region had been under German rule, with some Polish interludes, for 700 years, ever since the Order of Teutonic Knights established themselves there in 1225. Despite defeat in 1410 by Poles and Lithuanians in a great battle at a village called Tannenberg, the knights had remained and grown, or declined, into Junkers. In Königsberg, chief city of the region, the first Hohenzollern sovereign had been crowned King of Prussia in 1701. With its shores washed by the Baltic, with its king's city, where Prussia's sovereigns had been crowned, East Prussia was not a country the Germans would yield lightly. Along the river Angerapp, running through the Insterberg Gap, defence positions had been carefully prepared. In the swampy eastern region, roads had been built up as causeways, which would confine an enemy to their narrow crests. In addition, the whole of East Prussia was crisscrossed by a network of railroads, giving the defending army the advantage of mobility and rapid transfer from one front to the other to meet the advances of either enemy wing. When the Schlieffen Plan had been first adopted, fears for East Prussia were less, because it was assumed that Russia would have to keep large forces in the Far East to guard against Japan. German diplomacy, despite a certain record for clumsiness, was expected to overcome the Anglo-Japanese Treaty, an unnatural alliance, as Germany regarded it, and keep Japan neutral as a constant threat to Russia's rear. The German General Staff's specialist in Russian affairs was Lieutenant Colonel Max Hoffmann, whose task was to work out the probable Russian plan of campaign in a war with Germany. In his early 40s, Hoffmann was tall and heavily built, with a large, round head and a Prussian haircut shaved so close to the scalp it made him look bald. His expression was good-humoured but uncompromising. He wore black-rimmed glasses and carefully trained his black eyebrows to grow in a dashing upward curve at their outer ends. He was equally careful and proud of his small, delicate hands and impeccable trouser creases. Though indolent, he was resourceful. Though a poor rider, worse swordsman and gluttonous eater and drinker, he was quick-thinking and rapid in judgment. He was amiable, lucky, astute, and respected no one. In intervals of regimental duty before the war, he drank wine and consumed sausages all night at the officers' club until 7 a.m., when he took his company out on parade and returned for a snack of more sausages and 2 quarts of Moselle before breakfast. After graduation from the Staff College in 1898, Hoffmann had served a 6 months tour of duty in Russia as interpreter and 5 years subsequently in the Russian section of the General Staff under Schlieffen before going as Germany's military observer to the Russo-Japanese War. When a Japanese general refused him permission to watch a battle from a nearby hill, etiquette gave way to that natural quality in Germans whose expression so often fails to endear them to others. You are a yellow skin. You are uncivilized if you will not let me go to that hill. Hoffman yelled at the general, in the presence of other foreign attachés, and at least one correspondent. Belonging to a race hardly second to the Germans in sense of self-importance, the general yelled back, "We Japanese are paying for this military information with our blood, and we don't propose to share it with others." Protocol for the occasion broke down altogether. On his return to the general's staff under Moltke, Hoffman resumed work on the Russian plan of campaign. A colonel of the Russian general's staff had sold an early version of his country's plan for a high price in 1902, but since that time, according to Hoffman's not always wholly serious memoirs, the price had gone up beyond the stingy funds allotted to Germany's military intelligence. The terrain of East Prussia, however, made the general outlines of a Russian offensive self-evident. It would have to be a two-pronged advance around the Masurian Lakes. Hoffman's study of the Russian army and the factors governing its mobilization and transportation enabled the Germans to judge the timing of the offensive. The German army, inferior in numbers, could choose either of two ways to meet a superior force advancing in two wings. They could either withdraw or attack one wing before the other, whichever offered the best opportunity. The stern formula dictated by Schlieffen was to strike with all available strength at the first Russian army that came within reach. Outbreak. "Some damned foolish thing in the Balkans," Bismarck had predicted, would ignite the next war. The assassination of the Austrian heir apparent, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, by Serbian nationalists on June 28, 1914, satisfied his condition. Austria-Hungary, with the bellicose frivolity of senile empires, determined to use the occasion to absorb Serbia as she had absorbed Bosnia and Herzegovina in 1909. Russia, on that occasion, weakened by the war with Japan, had been forced to acquiesce by a German ultimatum followed by the Kaiser's appearance in shining armour, as he put it, at the side of his ally Austria. To avenge that humiliation, and for the sake of her prestige as the major Slav power, Russia was now prepared to put on the shining armour herself. On July 5, Germany assured Austria that she could count on Germany's faithful support if whatever punitive action she took against Serbia brought her into conflict with Russia. This was the signal that let loose the irresistible onrush of events. On July 23, Austria delivered an ultimatum to Serbia. On July 26, rejected the Serbian reply, although the Kaiser, now nervous, admitted that it dissipates every reason for war. On July 28, declared war on Serbia. On July 29, bombarded Belgrade. On that day, Russia mobilized along her Austrian frontier, and on July 30, both Austria and Russia ordered general mobilization. On July 31, Germany issued an ultimatum to Russia to demobilize within 12 hours and make us a distinct declaration to that effect. War pressed against every frontier. Suddenly dismayed, governments struggled and twisted to fend it off. It was no use. Agents at frontiers were reporting every cavalry patrol as a deployment to beat the mobilization gun. General staffs, goaded by their relentless timetables, were pounding the table for the signal to move, lest their opponents gain an hour's head start. Appalled upon the brink, the chiefs of state, who would be ultimately responsible for their country's fate, attempted to back away, but the pull of military schedules dragged them forward. Chapter 6. August 1, Berlin. At noon on Saturday, August 1, the German ultimatum to Russia expired without a Russian reply. Within an hour, a telegram went out to the German ambassador in St. Petersburg, instructing him to declare war by 5 o'clock that afternoon. At 5 o'clock, the Kaiser decreed general mobilization, some preliminaries having already got off to a head start under the declaration of Kriegsgefahr, danger of war, the day before. At 5:30, Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, absorbed in a document he was holding in his hand, and accompanied by little Yagov, the foreign minister, hurried down the steps of the Foreign Office, hailed an ordinary taxi, and sped off to the palace. Shortly afterward, General von Moltke, the gloomy chief of general staff, was pulled up short as he was driving back to his office with the mobilization order signed by the Kaiser in his pocket. A messenger in another car overtook him with an urgent summons from the palace. He returned to hear a last-minute desperate proposal from the Kaiser that reduced Moltke to tears and could have changed the history of the 20th century. Now that the moment had come, the Kaiser suffered at the necessary risk to East Prussia, in spite of the 6 weeks' leeway his staff promised before the Russians could fully mobilize. "I hate the Slavs," he confessed to an Austrian officer. "I know it is a sin to do so. We ought not to hate anyone, but I can't help hating them." He had taken comfort, however, in the news, reminiscent of 1905, of strikes and riots in St. Petersburg, of mobs smashing windows, and violent street fights between revolutionaries and police. Count Portales, his aged ambassador, who had been 7 years in Russia, concluded and repeatedly assured his government that Russia would not fight for fear of revolution. Captain von Egling, the German military attaché, kept repeating the credo about 1916, and when Russia nevertheless mobilized, he reported she planned no tenacious offensive but a slow retreat, as in 1812. In the affinity for error of German diplomats, these judgments established a record. They gave heart to the Kaiser, who as late as July 31 composed a missive for the guidance of his staff, rejoicing in the mood of a sick tomcat that, on the evidence of his envoys, he said prevailed in the Russian court and army. In Berlin on August 1, the crowds milling in the streets and massed in thousands in front of the palace were tense and heavy with anxiety. Socialism, which most of Berlin's workers professed, did not run so deep as their instinctive fear and hatred of the Slavic hordes. Although they'd been told by the Kaiser, in his speech from the balcony announcing Kriegsgefahr the evening before, that the sword has been forced into our hand, they still waited in the ultimate dim hope of a Russian reply. The hour of the ultimatum passed. A journalist in the crowd felt the air electric with rumour. People told each other Russia had asked for an extension of time. The Bourse writhed in panic. The afternoon passed in almost insufferable anxiety. Bethmann Hollweg issued a statement ending, "If the iron dice roll, may God help us." At 5 o'clock, a policeman appeared at the palace gate and announced mobilization to the crowd, which obediently struck up the national hymn, "Now Thank We All Our God." Cars raced down Unter den Linden, with officers standing up in them, waving handkerchiefs and shouting, "Mobilization!" Instantly converted from Marx to Mars, people cheered wildly and rushed off to vent their feelings on suspected Russian spies, several of whom were pummeled or trampled to death in the course of the next few days. Once the mobilization button was pushed, the whole vast machinery for calling up, equipping and transporting 2 million men began turning automatically. Reservists went to their designated depots, were issued uniforms, equipment and arms, formed into companies and companies into battalions, were joined by cavalry, cyclists, artillery, medical units, cook wagons, blacksmith wagons, even postal wagons, moved according to prepared railway timetables to concentration points near the frontier, where they would be formed into divisions, divisions into corps, and corps into armies, ready to advance and fight. One army corps alone, out of the total of 40 in the German forces, required 170 railway cars for officers, 965 for infantry, 2,960 for cavalry, 1,915 for artillery and supply wagons, 6,010 in all, grouped in 140 trains, and an equal number again for their supplies. From the moment the order was given, everything was to move at fixed times, according to a schedule precise down to the number of train axles that would pass over a given bridge within a given time. Confident in his magnificent system, Deputy Chief of Staff General Woldersee had not even returned to Berlin at the beginning of the crisis, but had written to Yagov, "I shall remain here ready to jump. We are all prepared at the General Staff. In the meantime, there is nothing for us to do." It was a proud tradition inherited from the elder or great Moltke, who on mobilisation day in 1870 was found lying on a sofa reading Lady Audley's Secret. His enviable calm was not present today in the palace. Face to face no longer with the spectre but the reality of a two-front war, the Kaiser was as close to the sick tomcat mood as he thought the Russians were. More cosmopolitan and more timid than the archetype Prussian, he had never actually wanted a general war. He wanted greater power, greater prestige, above all more authority in the world's affairs for Germany, but he preferred to obtain them by frightening rather than by fighting other nations. He wanted the gladiator's rewards without the battle, and whenever the prospect of battle came too close, as at Algeciras and Agadir, he shrank. As the final crisis boiled, his marginalia on telegrams grew more and more agitated. Aha, the common cheat! Rot! He lies! Mr. Grey is a false dog! Twaddle! The rascal is crazy or an idiot! When Russia mobilized, he burst into a tirade of passionate foreboding, not against the Slav traitors, but against the unforgettable figure of the wicked uncle. The world will be engulfed in the most terrible of wars, the ultimate aim of which is the ruin of Germany. England, France, and Russia have conspired for our annihilation. That is the naked truth of the situation, which was slowly but surely created by Edward VII. The encirclement of Germany is at last an accomplished fact. We have run our heads into the noose. The dead Edward is stronger than the living one. Conscious of the shadow of the dead Edward, the Kaiser would have welcomed any way out of the commitment to fight both Russia and France, and behind France the looming figure of still undeclared England. At the last moment, one was offered. A colleague of Bettmann's came to beg him to do anything he could to save Germany from a two-front war, and suggested a means. For years, a possible solution for Alsace had been discussed in terms of autonomy as a federal state within the German Empire. If offered and accepted by the Alsatians, this solution would have deprived France of any reason to liberate the lost provinces. As recently as July 16, the French Socialist Congress had gone on record in favour of it. But the German military had always insisted that the provinces must remain garrisoned and their political rights subordinated to military necessity. Until 1911, no constitution had ever been granted, and autonomy never. Bettmann's colleague now urged him to make an immediate, public and official offer for a conference on autonomy for Alsace. This could be allowed to drag on without result, while its moral effect would force France to refrain from attack while at least considering the offer. Time would be gained for Germany to turn her forces against Russia, while remaining stationary in the West, thus keeping England out. The author of this proposal remains anonymous, and it may be apocryphal. It does not matter. The opportunity was there, and the Chancellor could have thought of it for himself. But to seize it required boldness, and Bettmann, behind his distinguished facade of great height, sombre eyes, and well-trimmed imperial, was a man, as Theodore Roosevelt said of Taft, who means well feebly. Instead of offering France an inducement to stay neutral, the German government sent her an ultimatum at the same time as the ultimatum to Russia. They asked France to reply within 18 hours whether she would stay neutral in a Russo-German war, and added that if she did, Germany would demand as guarantee of neutrality the handing over to us of the fortresses of Toul and Verdun, which we shall occupy and restore after the war is over. In other words, the handing over of the key to the French door. Baron von Schön, German ambassador in Paris, could not bring himself to pass on this brutal demand at a moment when it seemed to him French neutrality would have been such a supreme advantage to Germany that his government might well have offered to pay a price for it rather than exact a penalty. He presented the request for a statement of neutrality without the demand for the fortresses, but the French, who had intercepted and decoded his instructions, knew of it anyway. When Schön, at 11 a.m. on August 1, asked for France's reply, he was answered that France would act in accordance with her interests. In Berlin, just after 5 o'clock, a telephone rang in the Foreign Office. Under-Secretary Zimmermann, who answered it, turned to the editor of the Berliner Tageblatt, sitting by his desk, and said, "Moltke wants to know whether things can start." At that moment, a telegram from London, just decoded, broke in upon the planned proceedings. It offered hope that if the movement against France could be instantly stopped, Germany might safely fight a one-front war after all. Carrying it with them, Bethmann and Yagov dashed off on their taxi trip to the palace. The telegram from Prince Lichnowsky, ambassador in London, reported an English offer, as Lichnowsky understood it, that in case we did not attack France, England would remain neutral and would guarantee France's neutrality. The ambassador belonged to that class of Germans who spoke English and copied English manners, sports and dress in a strenuous endeavour to become the very pattern of an English gentleman. His fellow noblemen, the Prince of Pless, Prince Blücher and Prince Münster, were all married to English wives. At a dinner in Berlin in 1911, in honour of a British general, the guest of honour was astonished to find that all 40 German guests, including Bethmann Hollweg and Admiral Tirpitz, spoke English fluently. Lichnowsky differed from his class in that he was not only in manner but in heart an earnest Anglophile. He had come to London determined to make himself and his country liked. English society had been lavish with country weekends. To the ambassador, no tragedy could be greater than war between the country of his birth and the country of his heart, and he was grasping at any handle to avert it. When the Foreign Secretary, Sir Edward Grey, telephoned him that morning, in the interval of a cabinet meeting, Lichnowsky, out of his own anxiety, interpreted what Grey said to him as an offer by England to stay neutral and to keep France neutral in a Russo-German war if, in return, Germany would promise not to attack France. Actually, Grey had not said quite that. What, in his elliptical way, he offered was a promise to keep France neutral if Germany would promise to stay neutral as against France and Russia. In other words, not go to war against either, pending the result of efforts to settle the Serbian affair. After 8 years as Foreign Secretary in a period of chronic Bosnias, as Bülow called them, Grey had perfected a manner of speaking designed to convey as little meaning as possible. His avoidance of the point-blank, said a colleague, almost amounted to method. Over the telephone, Lichnowsky, himself dazed by the coming tragedy, would have had no difficulty misunderstanding him. The Kaiser clutched at Lichnowsky's passport to a one-front war. Minutes counted. Already mobilization was rolling inexorably toward the French frontier. The first hostile act, seizure of a railway junction in Luxembourg, whose neutrality the five great powers, including Germany, had guaranteed, was scheduled within an hour. It must be stopped. Stopped at once. But how? Where was Moltke? Moltke had left the palace. An aide was sent off with sirens screaming to intercept him. He was brought back. The Kaiser was himself again, the all-highest, the warlord, blazing with a new idea, planning, proposing, disposing. He read Moltke the telegram and said in triumph, "Now we can go to war against Russia only. We simply march the whole of our army to the east." Aghast at the thought of his marvellous machinery of mobilisation wrenched into reverse, Moltke refused, point blank. For the past 10 years, first as assistant to Schlieffen, then as his successor, Moltke's job had been planning for this day, the day, der Tag, for which all Germany's energies were gathered, of which the march to final mastery of Europe would begin. It weighed upon him with an oppressive, almost unbearable responsibility. Tall, heavy, bald, and 66 years old, Moltke habitually wore an expression of profound distress, which led the Kaiser to call him Der Traurige Julius, or what might be rendered Gloomy Gus. In fact, his name was Helmut. Poor health, for which he took an annual cure at Carlsbad, and the shadow of a great uncle were perhaps cause for gloom. From his window in the red-brick General Staff building on the Königplatz, where he lived as well as worked, he looked out every day on the equestrian statue of his namesake, the hero of 1870, and, together with Bismarck, the architect of the German Empire. The nephew was a poor horseman with a habit of falling off on staff rides, and worse, a follower of Christian Science with a side interest in anthroposophism and other cults. For this unbecoming weakness in a Prussian officer, he was considered soft. What is more, he painted, played the cello, carried Goethe's Faust in his pocket, and had begun a translation of Maeterlinck's Pelléas et Mélisande. Introspective and a doubter by nature, he had said to the Kaiser upon his appointment in 1906, "I do not know how I shall get on in the event of a campaign. I am very critical of myself." Yet he was neither personally nor politically timid. In 1911, disgusted by Germany's retreat in the Agadir crisis, he wrote to Conrad von Hötzendorf that if things got worse he would resign, propose to disband the army, and place ourselves under the protection of Japan. Then we can make money undisturbed and turn into imbeciles. He did not hesitate to talk back to the Kaiser, but told him quite brutally in 1900 that his Peking expedition was a crazy adventure, and when offered the appointment as Chief of Staff, asked the Kaiser if he expected to win the big prize twice in the same lottery, a thought that had certainly influenced William's choice. He refused to take the post unless the Kaiser stopped his habit of winning all the war games, which was making nonsense of manoeuvres. Surprisingly, the Kaiser meekly obeyed. Now, on the climactic night of August 1, Moltke was in no mood for any more of the Kaiser's meddling with serious military matters, or for meddling of any kind with the fixed arrangements. To turn around the deployment of 1 million men from west to east at the very moment of departure would have taken a more iron nerve than Moltke disposed of. He saw a vision of the deployment crumbling apart in confusion. Supplies here, soldiers there, ammunition lost in the middle, companies without officers, divisions without staffs, and those 11,000 trains, each exquisitely scheduled to click over specified tracks at specified intervals of 10 minutes, tangled in a grotesque ruin of the most perfectly planned military movement in history. "Your Majesty," Moltke said to him now, "it cannot be done. The deployment of millions cannot be improvised. If Your Majesty insists on leading the whole army to the east, it will not be an army ready for battle, but a disorganized mob of armed men with no arrangements for supply. Those arrangements took a whole year of intricate labor to complete." And Moltke closed upon that rigid phrase, the basis for every major German mistake, the phrase that launched the invasion of Belgium and the submarine war against the United States, the inevitable phrase when military plans dictate policy, "and once settled, it cannot be altered." In fact, it could have been altered. The German General Staff, though committed since 1905 to a plan of attack upon France first, had in their files, revised each year until 1913, an alternative plan against Russia, with all the trains running eastward. "Build no more fortresses, build railways," ordered the elder Moltke, who had laid out his strategy on a railway map and bequeathed the dogma that railways are the key to war. In Germany, the railway system was under military control, with a staff officer assigned to every line. No track could be laid or changed without permission of the general staff. Annual mobilization war games kept railway officials in constant practice and tested their ability to improvise and divert traffic by telegrams reporting lines cut and bridges destroyed. The best brains produced by the War College, it was said, went into the railway section and ended up in lunatic asylums. When Moltke's "It Cannot Be Done" was revealed after the war in his memoirs, General von Stab, chief of the railway division, was so incensed by what he considered a reproach upon his bureau that he wrote a book to prove it could have been done. In pages of charts and graphs, he demonstrated how, given notice on August 1, he could have deployed 4 out of the 7 armies to the Eastern Front by August 15, leading 3 to defend the West. Matthias Erzberger, the Reichstag deputy and leader of the Catholic Centrist Party, has left another testimony. He says that Moltke himself, within 6 months of the event, admitted to him that the assault on France at the beginning was a mistake, and instead the larger part of our army ought first to have been sent east to smash the Russian steamroller, limiting operations in the west to beating off the enemy's attack on our frontier. On the night of August 1, Moltke, clinging to the fixed plan, lacked the necessary nerve. "Your uncle would have given me a different answer," the Kaiser said to him bitterly. The reproach wounded me deeply, Moltke wrote afterwards. I never pretended to be the equal of the old field marshal. Nevertheless, he continued to refuse. My protest that it would be impossible to maintain peace between France and Germany while both countries were mobilized made no impression. Everybody got more and more excited, and I was alone in my opinion. Finally, when Moltke convinced the Kaiser that the mobilization plan could not be changed, the group, which included Beckmann and Jagow, drafted a telegram to England, regretting that Germany's advance movements toward the French border can no longer be altered, but offering a guarantee not to cross the border before August 3 at 7 p.m., which cost them nothing, as no crossing was scheduled before that time. Jagow rushed off a telegram to his ambassador in Paris, where mobilization had already been decreed at 4 o'clock, instructing him helpfully to please keep France quiet for the time being. The Kaiser added a personal telegram to King George, telling him that for technical reasons, mobilization could not be countermanded at this late hour, but if France offers me neutrality, which must be guaranteed by the British fleet and army, I shall of course refrain from attacking France and employ my troops elsewhere. I hope France will not become nervous. It was now minutes before 7 o'clock, the hour when the 16th Division was scheduled to move into Luxembourg. Beckmann excitedly insisted that Luxembourg must not be entered under any circumstances while waiting for the British answer. Instantly, the Kaiser, without asking Moltke, ordered his aide-de-camp to telephone and telegraph 16th Division headquarters at Trier to cancel the movement. Moltke saw ruin again. Luxembourg's railways were essential for the offensive through Belgium against France. At that moment, his memoirs say, I thought my heart would break. Despite all his pleading, the Kaiser refused to budge. Instead, he added a closing sentence to his telegram to King George. The troops on my frontier are in the act of being stopped by telephone and telegraph from crossing into France. A slight, if vital, twist of the truth, for the Kaiser could not acknowledge to England that what he had intended and what was being stopped was the violation of a neutral country. It would have implied his intention also to violate Belgium, which would have been casus belli in England, and England's mind was not yet made up. Crushed, Moltke says of himself, on what should have been the culminating day of his career, he returned to the General's staff and burst into bitter tears of abject despair. When his aide brought him for his signature the written order cancelling the Luxembourg movement, I threw my pen down on the table and refused to sign. To have signed, as the first order after mobilization, one that would have annulled all the careful preparations, would have been taken, he knew, as evidence of hesitancy and irresolution. Do what you want with this telegram, he said to his aide. I will not sign it. He was still brooding at 11 o'clock when another summons came from the palace. Moltke found the Kaiser in his bedroom, characteristically dressed for the occasion with a military overcoat over his nightshirt. A telegram had come from Lichnowsky, who in a further talk with Grey had discovered his error and now wired sadly, a positive proposal by England is on the whole not in prospect. Now you can do what you like, said the Kaiser, and went back to bed. Moltke, the commander-in-chief who had now to direct a campaign that would decide the fate of Germany, was left permanently shaken. That was my first experience of the war, he wrote afterward. I never recovered from the shock of this incident. Something in me broke, and I was never the same thereafter. Neither was the world, he might have added. The Kaiser's telephone order to Trier had not arrived in time. At 7 o'clock, as scheduled, the first frontier of the war was crossed, the distinction going to an infantry company of the 69th Regiment, under command of a certain Lieutenant Feldmann. Just inside the Luxembourg border, on the slopes of the Ardennes, about 12 miles from Bastogne in Belgium, stood a little town known to the Germans as Ulflingen. Around it cows grazed on the hillside pastures. On its steep cobblestone streets, not a stray wisp of hay, even in August harvest time, was allowed to offend the strict laws governing municipal cleanliness in the Grand Duchy. At the foot of the town was a railroad station and telegraph office, where the lines from Germany and Belgium crossed. This was the German objective, which Lieutenant Feldman's company, arriving in automobiles, duly seized. With their relentless talent for the tactless, the Germans chose to violate Luxembourg at a place whose native and official name was Trois Vierges, Three Virgins. The Three Virgins, in fact, represented faith, hope, and charity, but history, with her apposite touch, arranged for the occasion that they should stand in the public mind for Luxembourg, Belgium, and France. At 7:30, a second detachment in automobiles arrived, presumably in response to the Kaiser's message, and ordered off the first group, saying a mistake had been made. In the interval, Luxembourg's Minister of State, Eichen, had already telegraphed the news to London, Paris, and Brussels, and a protest to Berlin. The Three Virgins had made their point. By midnight, Moltke had rectified the reversal, and by the end of the next day, August 2, M1 on the German schedule, the entire Grand Duchy was occupied. A question has haunted the annals of history ever since. What ifs might have followed if the Germans had gone east in 1914 while remaining on the defensive against France? General von Staub showed that to have turned against Russia was technically possible, but whether it would have been temperamentally possible for the Germans to have refrained from attacking France when Der Tag came is another matter. At 7 o'clock in St. Petersburg, at the same hour when the Germans entered Luxembourg, Ambassador Pourtalès, his watery blue eyes red-rimmed, his white goatee quivering, presented Germany's declaration of war with shaking hand to Sazonov, the Russian foreign minister. "The curses of the nations will be upon you," Sazonov exclaimed. "We are defending our honour," the German ambassador replied. "Your honour was not involved, but there is a divine justice."
"That's true," and muttering, "A divine justice, a divine justice."
Pourtalès staggered to the window, leaned against it, and burst into tears. "So this is the end of my mission," he said when he could speak. Sazonov patted him on the shoulder, they embraced, and Pourtalès stumbled to the door, which he could hardly open with a trembling hand, and went out, murmuring, "Goodbye, goodbye." This affecting scene comes down to us as recorded by Sazonov, with artistic additions by the French ambassador Paleolog, presumably from what Sazonov told him. Pourtalès reported only that he asked three times for a reply to the ultimatum, and after Sazonov answered negatively three times, "I handed over the note as instructed." Why did it have to be handed over at all? Admiral von Tirpitz, the naval minister, had plaintively asked the night before when the declaration of war was being drafted. Speaking, he says, more from instinct than from reason, he wanted to know why, if Germany did not plan to invade Russia, was it necessary to declare war and assume the odium of the attacking party? His question was particularly pertinent because Germany's object was to saddle Russia with war guilt in order to convince the German people that they were fighting in self-defense, and especially in order to keep Italy tied to her engagements under the Triple Alliance. Italy was obliged to join her allies only in a defensive war, and already shaky in her allegiance, was widely expected to sidle out through any loophole that opened up. Bettmann was harassed by this problem. If Austria persisted in refusing any or all Serbian concessions, he warned, it will scarcely be possible to place the guilt of a European conflagration on Russia, and would place us in the eyes of our own people in an untenable position. He was hardly heard. When mobilization day came, German protocol required that war be properly declared. Jurists of the Foreign Office, according to Tirpitz, insisted it was legally the correct thing to do. "Outside Germany," he says pathetically, "there is no appreciation of such ideas." In France, appreciation was keener than he knew. Chapter 7. August 1. Paris and London. One prime objective governed French policy: to enter the war with England as an ally. To ensure that event and enable her friends in England to overcome the inertia and reluctance within their own cabinet and country, France had to leave it clear beyond question who was the attacked and who the attacker.
The physical act and moral odium of aggression must be left squarely upon Germany. Germany was expected to do her part, but lest any over-anxious French patrols or frontier troops stepped over the border, the French government took a daring and extraordinary step. On July 30, it ordered a 10-kilometre withdrawal along the entire frontier with Germany from Switzerland to Luxembourg. Premier René Viviani, an eloquent socialist orator, formerly chiefly concerned with welfare and labour, proposed the withdrawal. He was a curiosity in French politics, a premier who had never been premier before and was now acting foreign minister as well. He had been in office barely 6 weeks and had just returned the day before, July 29, from a state visit to Russia with President Poincaré. Austria had waited until Viviani and Poincaré were at sea to issue her ultimatum to Serbia. Upon receiving this news, the French president and premier had eliminated a scheduled visit to Copenhagen and hurried home. In Paris, they were told German covering troops had taken their places a few hundred metres from the frontier. They knew nothing as yet of the Russian and Austrian mobilisation. Hopes still flourished of a negotiated settlement. Viviani was haunted by a fear that war might burst from a clump of trees, from a meeting of two patrols, from a threatening gesture, a black look, a brutal word, a shot. While there was still even the least chance of settling the crisis without war, and in order to leave the lines of aggression clear if war came, the cabinet agreed upon the 10-kilometre withdrawal. The order, telegraphed to corps commanders, was designed, they were told, to assure the collaboration of our English neighbours. A telegram informing England of the measure went out simultaneously. The act of withdrawal, done at the very portals of invasion, was a calculated military risk deliberately taken for its political effect. It was taking a chance never before taken in history, said Viviani, and might have added, like Cyrano, "Ah, but what a gesture!" Withdrawal was a bitter gesture to ask of a French commander-in-chief schooled in the doctrine of offensive and nothing but the offensive. It could have shattered General Joffre, as Moltke's first experience of the war shattered him, but General Joffre's heart did not break. From the moment of the President's and Premier's return, Joffre had been hounding the government for the order to mobilise, or at least take the preliminary steps, recall of furloughs, of which many had been granted for the harvest, and deployment of covering troops to the frontier. He deluged them with intelligence reports of German pre-mobilisation measures already taken. He loomed large in authority before a newborn cabinet, the 10th in 5 years, whose predecessor had lasted 3 days. The present one was remarkable chiefly for having most of France's strong men outside it. Briand, Clemenceau, Caillaux, all former premiers, were in opposition. Viviani, by his own evidence, was in a state of frightful nervous tension, which, according to Messimi, who was once again war minister, became a permanent condition during the month of August. The Minister of Marine, Dr. Gauthier, a doctor of medicine, shoved into the naval post when a political scandal removed his predecessor, was so overwhelmed by events that he forgot to order fleet units into the Channel and had to be replaced by the Minister of Public Instruction on the spot. In the President, however, intelligence, experience and strength of purpose, if not constitutional power, were combined. Poincaré was a lawyer, economist and member of the Academy, a former finance minister who had served as premier and foreign minister in 1912 and had been elected president of France in January 1913. Character begets power, especially in hours of crisis, and the untried cabinet leaned willingly on the abilities and strong will of the man who was constitutionally a cipher. Born in Lorraine, Poincaré could remember as a boy of 10 the long line of spiked German helmets marching through Bar-le-Duc, his hometown. He was credited by the Germans with the most bellicose intent, partly because, as premier at the time of Agadir, he had held firm, partly because, as president, he had used his influence to push through the 3-year military service law in 1913 against violent socialist opposition. This, and his cold demeanour, his lack of flamboyance, his fixity, did not make for popularity at home. Elections were going against the government. The 3-year law was near to being thrown out. Labour troubles and farmers' discontent were rife. July had been hot, wet, and oppressive with windstorms and summer thunder, and Madame Caillot, who had shot the editor of Figaro, was on trial for murder. Each day of the trial revealed new and unpleasant irregularities in finance, the press, the courts, the government. One day the French woke up to find Madame Caillot on page 2, and the sudden awful knowledge that France faced war. In that most passionately political and quarrelsome of countries, one sentiment thereupon prevailed. Poincaré and Viviani, returning from Russia, drove through Paris to the sound of one prolonged cry repeated over and over, "Vive la France!" Joffre told the government that if he was not given the order to assemble and transport the covering troops of 5 army corps and cavalry towards the frontier, the Germans would enter France without firing a shot. He accepted the 10-kilometer withdrawal of troops already in position, less from subservience to the civil arm — Joffre was about as subservient by nature as Julius Caesar — as from a desire to bend all the force of his argument upon the one issue of the covering troops. The government, still reluctant, while diplomatic offers and counter-offers flashing over the wires might yet produce a settlement, agreed to give him a reduced version, that is, without calling out the reservists. At 4:30 next day, July 31, a banking friend in Amsterdam telephoned Messimy the news of the Germans' Kriegsgefahr, officially confirmed an hour later from Berlin. It was une forme hypocrite de la mobilisation, Messimy angrily told the cabinet. His friend in Amsterdam had said war was certain and Germany was ready for it, from the emperor down to the last Fritz. Following hard upon this news came a telegram from Paul Cambon, French ambassador in London, reporting that England was tepid. Cambon had devoted every day of the past 16 years at his post to the single end of ensuring England's active support when the time came. But he had now to wire that the British government seemed to be awaiting some new development. The dispute so far was of no interest to Great Britain. Joffre arrived with a new memorandum on German movements to insist upon mobilisation. He was permitted to send his full covering order, but no more, as news had also come of a last-minute appeal from the Tsar to the Kaiser. The cabinet continued sitting, with Messimy champing in impatience at the green baize routine which stipulated that each minister must speak in turn. At 7 o'clock in the evening, Baron von Schön, making his 11th visit to the French Foreign Office in 7 days, presented Germany's demand to know what course France would take, and said he would return next day at 1 o'clock for an answer. Still, the cabinet sat and argued over financial measures, recall of Parliament, declaration of a state of siege, while all Paris waited in suspense. One crazed young man, cracked under the agony, held a pistol against a café window, and shot dead Jean Jaurès, whose leadership in international socialism and in a fight against the three-year law had made him, in the eyes of superpatriots, a symbol of pacifism. A white-faced aide broke in upon the cabinet at 9 o'clock with the news, Jaurès killed. The event, pregnant with possible civil strife, stunned the cabinet. Street barricades, riot, even revolt became a prospect on the threshold of war. Ministers reopened the heated argument whether to invoke Carnet B, the list of known agitators, anarchists, pacifists, and suspected spies, who were to be arrested automatically upon the day of mobilisation. Both the Prefect of Police and former Premier Clemenceau had advised the Minister of Interior, Monsieur Malvy, to enforce Carnet B. Viviani and others of his colleagues, hoping to preserve national unity, were opposed to it. They held firm. Some foreigners suspected of being spies were arrested, but no Frenchmen. In case of riot, troops were alerted that night, but next morning there was only deep grief and deep quiet. Of the 2,501 persons listed in Carnet B, 80% were ultimately to volunteer for military service. At 2 a.m. that night, President Poincaré was awakened in bed by the irrepressible Russian ambassador Izvolsky, a former hyperactive foreign minister. Very distressed and very agitated, he wanted to know, what is France going to do? Izvolsky had no doubts of Poincaré's attitude, but he and other Russian statesmen were always haunted by the fear that, when the time came, the French Parliament, which had never been told the terms of the military alliance with Russia, would fail to ratify it. The terms specifically stated, if Russia is attacked by Germany or by Austria supported by Germany, France will use all her available forces to attack Germany. As soon as either Germany or Austria mobilized, France and Russia, without previous agreement being necessary, shall mobilize all their forces immediately and simultaneously and shall transport them as near the frontiers as possible. These forces shall begin complete action with all speed, so that Germany will have to fight at the same time in the east and in the west. These terms appeared unequivocal, but as Ivolsky had anxiously queried Poincaré in 1912, would the French Parliament recognize the obligation? In Russia, the Tsar's power was absolute, so that France may be sure of us. But in France, the government is impotent without Parliament. Parliament does not know the text of 1892. What guarantee have we that your Parliament would follow your government's lead? If Germany attacked, Poincaré had replied on that earlier occasion, Parliament would follow the government without a doubt. Now, facing Ivolsky again in the middle of the night, Poincaré assured him that a cabinet would be called within a few hours to supply the answer. At the same hour, the Russian military attaché, in full diplomatic dress, appeared in Messimi's bedroom to pose the same question. Messimi telephoned to Premier Viviani, who, though exhausted by the night's events, had not yet gone to bed. "Good God!" he exploded. "These Russians are worse insomniacs than they are drinkers!" And he excitedly recommended, "Du calme, du calme, et encore du calme." Pressed by the Russians to declare themselves and by Joffre to mobilize, yet held to a standstill by the need to prove to England that France would act only in self-defense, the French government found calm not easy. At 8 next morning, August 1, Joffre came to the War Office in the Rue Saint-Dominique to beg Messimi, in a pathetic tone that contrasted with his habitual calm, to pry mobilization from the government. He named 4 o'clock as the last moment when the order could reach the General Post Office for dispatch by telegraph throughout France in time for mobilization to begin at midnight. He went with Messimi to the cabinet at 9 a.m. and presented an ultimatum of his own. Every further delay of 24 hours before general mobilization would mean a 15 to 20 kilometer loss of territory, and he would refuse to take the responsibility as commander. He left, and the cabinet faced the problem. Poincaré was for action. Viviani, representing the anti-war tradition, still hoped that time would provide a solution. At 11 he was called to the Foreign Office to see von Schön, who in his own anxiety had arrived 2 hours early for the answer to Germany's question of the previous day, whether France would stay neutral in a Russo-German war. "My question is rather naive," said the unhappy ambassador, "for we know you have a treaty of alliance." "Evidemment," replied Viviani, and gave the answer prearranged between him and Poincaré. "France will act in accordance with her interests." As Schön left, Ivolsky rushed in with news of the German ultimatum to Russia. Viviani returned to the cabinet, which at last agreed upon mobilization. The order was signed and given to Messimi, but Viviani, still hoping for some saving development to turn up within the few remaining hours, insisted that Messimi keep it in his pocket until 3:30. At the same time, the 10-kilometer withdrawal was reaffirmed. Messimi telephoned it that evening personally to corps commanders. "By order of the President of the Republic, no unit of the army, no patrol, no reconnaissance, no scout, no detail of any kind shall go east of the line laid down. Anyone guilty of transgressing will be liable to court-martial." A particular warning was added for the benefit of the 20th Corps, commanded by General Foch, of whom it was reliably reported that a squadron of cuirassiers had been seen nose to nose with a squadron of Uhlans. At 3:30, as arranged, General Ebinar of Joffre's staff, accompanied by 2 officers, came to the War Office to call for the mobilization order. Messimi handed it over in dry-throated silence. conscious of the gigantic and infinite results to spread from that little piece of paper, all four of us felt our hearts tighten. He shook hands with each of the three officers, who saluted and departed to deliver the order to the post office. At 4 o'clock, the first poster appeared on the walls of Paris. At the corner of the Place de la Concorde and the Rue Royale, one still remains, preserved under glass. At Armenonville, rendezvous of the Haute Monde in the Bois de Boulogne, tea dancing